The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
Our guest today is the award-winning medical doctor, Jane Orion, also known as Dr. Aunt Jane on her Twitter page. This is the second time we've had Dr. Orion on the show, so you can be sure this will be a great program. As we described back in May when she was last on, Dr. Orion is an Arizona-based physician in private practice who focuses on general internal medicine. She is the executive director of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. She's also the president of Doctors for Disaster Preparedness and was the recipient of that organization's Edward Teller Award and many other awards and honors from other organizations. Dr. Orient is the author of many books, op-ed pieces, and scientific papers, and on December 8th, testified in front of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee on the Treatment for COVID-19. So we're certainly fortunate to have you on the show again, Dr. Orient. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Jane, this is exciting for me to have an opportunity to ask you so many questions and talk about problems with medicine. But it all started with my concern over the fact that about every third person I met had an artificial knee or an artificial hip. And without exception, they were overweight. And I thought perhaps the medical industry was installing more artificial joints than were necessary and called for by good medical advice. Now, I say this being the recipient of an artificial knee a dozen years ago. Mine was actually installed essentially as emergency surgery when I was hurt catching in a baseball game and a runner slid right into me, landed his cleats right on my knee, and it swelled up. And literally, I went home, and the next day they gave me an artificial knee. The knee is so good that I couldn't swear in court that I have an artificial knee, except for the scar I can see running down it because it feels like a regular knee. But starting there with problems in medicine, the too much medicine, too many drugs, we have a list of questions. And one of the interesting things we did this week in publishing an article at America Out Loud, as we do every week, and talking about the fact that you would be on our show, we actually listed the questions that we were going to ask you, and thought that might drive an even bigger audience to our weekend radio show that adds every Saturday and Sunday at 11 in the morning and 8 in the evening. So let me just start off. I know you're not an orthopedic surgeon. I know you don't have, to my best of my knowledge, you don't have an artificial joint. Though if you do, you'll tell us. But do you think artificial joints are overused in medicine, perhaps to avoid people losing weight to reduce the stress on their joints?
Well, I think that they are overused. I think they're being put in people who are too young, because these do have a limited time. The knee that you were born with is supposed to last you till you die, although it may not function all that well as you get older. But these artificial joints do have a time that where they're not going to survive. You know, they may break or develop other problems. I don't know that people have the joints put in to avoid losing weight, I think that the surgeon may require a certain amount of weight loss before they put the joint in because they figure the joint can't take the weight. So, but certainly if you are overweight, you are damaging your joints and you could do yourself a lot of good by reducing that weight.
Well, it's what you say is what the doctor told me, that the joint had a limited time span. And I had been running marathons at the time that the knee was installed, and he strongly recommended I give up running long distances, or I might have the time that it would last. He expected it could last 15 years, and he thought that if I kept running marathons, it would cut in half. I did stop running those lengths, but I'm over 10 years now and have yet to notice any deterioration. As I said earlier, I couldn't swear that I actually had an artificial knee. But there are, it seems to me, many areas in medicine that are overdone. I think the amount of tests that are given with every illness has gotten a little crazy. There is so much technology available, it seems that on to be on the safe side, doctors want to have test after test given to their patient to be absolutely sure they don't make a mistake. It might have something to do with insurance. I'm not sure, but what are your opinions about the increase in the number of tests given to the average patient?
I think most patients can't get out of the emergency room without having a CT scan or some other sophisticated test that certainly wasn't even available when I was a medical student. Whether we make more diagnoses and more accurate diagnosis is a matter of opinion. On autopsies, we find that just about the same proportion of diagnoses are missed as before we had this technology. And I think doctors in the ER often just send the patient off to the imaging suite instead of getting an accurate history and physical exam in order to narrow down what the diagnosis probably is.
How about prescription drugs moving? That's always concerned me. Personally, I avoid prescription drugs at all costs. I take seriously the paperwork that comes with them about all the potential side effects, most of which sound much worse than the reason one would take a prescription drug. So I avoid them. Now, I know the government has come down on overprescription, certainly of opioids and painkillers. But in general, where do you stand on prescription drugs?
We had an excellent article in our journal by Marilyn Singleton, who is also a lawyer as well as a physician, called Somatizing America, that a lot of older people are on at least 5 or 6 prescription drugs, some of them to overcome the side effects of the first drugs that they were given. And a lot of them are what we used to call mind-altering drugs, antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs, sleep medicines, and so on and on. And there are, as you say, a lot of adverse effects that may be cumulative, they may be additive or synergistic. And so I agree with you that we really should minimize this. And one of the most useful things I've ever done as a general internist is start discontinuing patients' drugs.
That's very interesting. I'm thinking that I'm kind of off the charts at 85, not being on a single drug. I think I have a good lifestyle, but mostly I guess I'm lucky because I don't know that I know anybody else that is not on some kind of regular medication. Tom is also a fitness fanatic like me. Tom, what's your background in terms of prescriptions?
Well, generally I find that when I get out for a good run or a good bike ride, I don't know what it is, but something about it just makes me feel healthy. You know, like I can feel tired and it gives me more energy. You know, after this interview, I'll be doing weights down in the basement. And I find that it's the equivalent of taking an Ativan if I'm uptight. I mean, it just drives it away. And, you know, it's funny because a psychologist told me years ago, she said, to get rid of anxiety, I should exercise till I sweat. And quite frankly, it works.
I know of one person who was just really debilitated by depression quite frequently, and he got over that when he got rid of his car and started riding his bicycle, which is kind of a feat since he's a house painter and he has to carry his ladders and everything along behind his bicycle. But he felt that it did a tremendous amount, not just for his physical fitness, but for his mental fitness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess a question that a lot of people are asking when it comes to prescription drugs is pushing everyone to get the COVID injection. Is that an example of medication overkill in the society at large?
Well, I think it's worse than that. I think that there is a global effort to get that jab into everybody's arm, whether they need it or not. And certainly if you've had COVID and recovered from it, I think it does you no good at all and leaves you subject to all the adverse effects or maybe even worse adverse effects. Plus, this is predicated on saying that there is no successful early treatment for COVID-19. And yet hundreds of doctors and many thousands of patients are testifying that there really is effective early treatment with vitamin D, with zinc, with other supplements, with older repurposed drugs that have been around for 60 plus years and at least mm-hmm. have been shown to be safe.
Yeah, I got an email from a friend the other day, and he said he was checking the database by the World Health Organization. And tell me, is this correct? He said, ivermectin is a drug that has been used for decades and administered to billions of people. It has 5,063 records of adverse drug reaction. Comirnaty is Pfizer's mRNA experimental drug, has been used for 18 months and administered to millions of people, certainly a lot less than ivermectin, and it has over 2 million records of adverse drug reactions. Do you think he's interpreted the database correctly?
I think he has, and those adverse reactions include death. And at least 13,000 have reportedly been sent to the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. According to one CDC whistleblower, there may have been 40,000 deaths associated with, although you can't really prove a causal relationship. But many of these were in fairly young, previously healthy individuals who had no pre-existing conditions. We don't have records of the autopsies. In most cases, they weren't done. So we don't really know what they died of, but the timing is certainly suggestive.
Yeah, it's such a tragedy, that a young, healthy person who's very, very, very unlikely to die from COVID then dies from the injection to prevent COVID or to at least reduce the symptoms. So, I mean, that seems tragic. And I'm not surprised that a lot of NBA and other professional athletes, apparently the top tennis player in the men's circuit in the world today, won't take it. I mean, surely what they're saying makes a lot of sense. They don't need it, do they?
They do not need it. If they get COVID, they will probably recover uneventfully, especially if they're treated early. But maybe a third of the military doesn't want the injection, and many of them are going to give up their careers. And how many pilots or SEALs can we afford to lose? Either mm-hmm. from declining to take the injection and getting kicked out, or from getting the injection and being grounded. Sometimes for migraine, psychological effects, paralysis, or heart failure. Like previously, nobody in the world was more fit or more healthy than they. And yet, after the injection, they are undeployable.
Mm. Are the statistics available concerning military reactions, since they're all being forced into it?
It's hard to find out the statistics. It's very difficult to get to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Moving away for a moment from the virus and the vaccine, I've read a great deal that the new government controls on pain medications are actually interfering with the needs of patients. In other words, there are many people that are in continuous pain through no cause of their own and require regular pain medication. And because of all the problems with opioids and the huge furor over deaths from opioids, I'm hearing that patients that have a real need, there's no problem of overuse with them, are having difficulty getting these pain medications. Is there truth to that?
Absolutely, there is. The number of prescriptions written by physicians has declined precipitously with no effect whatsoever, or maybe even an increase in the deaths from opioids, people who are post-operative and who have every reason to be in intense pain may have difficulty getting sufficient pain medication. People with chronic pain, they're treated like criminals to begin with, and then maybe they can't find a doctor at all, especially after the state medical board has gone after their doctor, or even the Department of Justice for a medically illegitimate reason, despite the fact the patient had been on the same dose for years and years and was able to function and simply can't function without the medicine. We say, well, maybe they should get their pain treated. And gee, if I knew how to cure back pain or some of these other chronic pain syndromes, I would be rich and famous. But they have been controlled with medications. They're not controlled without it. How many suicides result from this? I don't know. How many of them result to the black market and are taking heroin or other drugs that may, or even fentanyl that may contaminate what they're given? We don't know. But certainly
this runs counter. Most people feel, oh, the pharmaceutical companies are too powerful and are controlling medicine. One would think the power of the pharmaceutical companies would have been able to stop the government from limiting the pain medications they're able to sell.
One might think so. Maybe the pain manufacturer partly responsible for advertising their drugs very heavily as being non-addictive and so on. But I think the government bears a big part of the responsibility for having this pain as the so-called fifth vital sign and saying that you really are supposed to get patients completely pain-free while they're in the hospital, overuse the medications. It's part of the patient satisfaction survey also, whether their pain was completely controlled. So there has been a governmental incentive to prescribe more than the patient really needed. And this may increase the rates of dependence.
You know, one question I've heard from a few circles is it a good thing necessarily to always reduce the symptoms of a disease? Because for example, with the COVID, if you reduce the symptoms to the point where people start to go out and mix with people when they otherwise should stay home, is it possible that in some cases, taking the vaccine to so-called reduce the symptoms might actually be counterproductive to society at large?
Well, people who have gotten the vaccine may be shedding at least as much virus as people who have not been vaccinated. If it does reduce the symptoms, they may be less likely to quarantine themselves. So that's a very good point.
Now, Jane, you've been, as I read much of your material for a very, very long time, you've been skeptical about vaccines long before the COVID virus. Could you tell us some of your background in that area in earlier problems where you were concerned about vaccines?
Well, of course, if you have a question about any of the vaccines that are on the sacred immunization schedule, you're immediately tarred as being anti-vax. Let me just say, I am against any medical treatment that is unnecessary or for which the benefits don't exceed the harm for the individual patients. So I would say that there are some vaccines that clearly are necessary. You absolutely need a rabies shot if you get bitten by a rabid animal, or if you're a veterinarian or animal trainer and are at high risk, or you'd like to explore bat caves, you need a rabies shot. Otherwise, you can't get a smallpox vaccine now, even if you're worried about it, except for some elements of the military, because the death rate from the vaccine is not insignificant. Tetanus shots, I wouldn't want to be without a tetanus shot. I never want to see another case of tetanus. But many of the other illnesses are so uncommon, or the likelihood of a bad outcome is so little, or the immunity from the vaccines is so inferior to natural immunity that one can make a strong case that at least for most patients, the benefits of the vaccine are less than the harms, and all vaccines have side effects. Just read the package insert. They all have encephalitis, which can lead to chronic neurologic disability, including ADHD or seizures or learning disabilities or even autism. All of them have that in the package insert. Almost all of them say that they don't know the long-term effects on cancer, carcinogenesis, or birth defects. So I would say, like for any other medical intervention, you don't just use them on everybody without a reason.
Mm-hmm. Most of the people I've talked to who are opposed to the vaccine will say it was never properly tested, let's say the way measles and mumps and chickenpox were when for children a half a century or more ago. Is that accurate?
Oh, certainly it's accurate. Before approval of the vaccine, they did have to be studied for maybe 10 or 15 years. And even so, a lot of the vaccine testing is not what I would consider adequate, because sometimes there was no placebo controlled, sometimes another vaccine that again had not been tested against a placebo control was used as the so-called placebo. And because there is no manufacturer's liability for these, since that an act was passed virtually immunizing them. And that came about because the drug companies were getting hit with so many lawsuits over permanent neurologic disability, primarily from the old wholesale pertussis vaccine, that they said, we're not going to make these things anymore unless you immunize us. So now there is a government program, and every dose of the vaccine has like a 75 cent tax on it that's supposed to compensate the victims, realizing there will be victims. More than $4 billion has been paid out, and the government is extremely stingy. They fight every single award, and the statute of limitations is very short. So there are harms in vaccine. Whether the benefits exceed the harm, we can argue about it, but we do at least have to acknowledge that they are not absolutely safe.
One thing that's interesting to me is the necessity for a control group that is big enough that you can actually do a proper study and compare with or without the vaccine. Aren't we approaching the point fairly quickly where the control group of people who haven't had the vaccine will be too small for this experiment to actually unfold properly?
I think if Dr. Fauci is this way, the control group will be virtually zero. And we also have this problem with the childhood vaccines. We have never tested them in combinations. We have never tested them being given repeatedly year after year. So we don't really know what the actual results would be. And because very few people are unimmunized, we need to have a really good experiment showing what is the outcome in children who don't get all these vaccines compared with those who do.
Jane, I'm really very concerned. I grew up thinking the Centers of Disease Control was among the very best government agencies we have. And I've watched them falter, if not crumble, in recent months over the various directives that come out from them about the virus. What is your opinion of the CDC now, where it was a decade ago, and what has happened to it as an outstanding government organization?
The CDC has been corrupted for many years. The CDC Foundation has a very, very long list of companies sponsoring it that have a huge vested interest. Some people say it's really a vaccine company rather than a scientific organization. They have patents, they get royalties. The agency itself, as well as individual members of it. We have an article about that in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons by Dr. Huntoon. If you go to japands.org, you can find that. But I think there are so many conflicts of interest and so little congressional oversight. And even the court systems give huge deference to the administrative state, especially to these public health organizations. So that it's becoming increasingly difficult to have confidence in what they say.
Wow. Well, that's a good place to take our first break. When we get back after the break, Dr. Orient, I was hoping to ask you about one thing. You said that you would recommend vaccines only taking into account the benefits to the risk to the individual patient. And of course, we're hearing all the time that we should take the vaccine not so much for ourselves, but for society at large. It's responsible. So when we come back after the break, I'm hoping we can talk about that.
Sure.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. Boost your brain power with Healthy Cells Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology, designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Let's get real, let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is McCullough Report. Are you tired of your tired vitamins? Consider Healthy Cell. These are pill-free vitamins that are in convenient gel packs. I like the Focus and Recall supplement. I use this a lot. You know, your brain uses a lot of energy and it depends on a variety of micronutrients and vitamins. Boost your short-term focus and long-term brain power with Healthy Cell's Focus and Recall vitamins. So go to HealthyCell.com, use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any Healthy Cell product. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
While the cancel culture is determined to destroy our history, bringing violence and terror to city streets, America Out Loud will enhance its own message of love and honor for the American traditions and constitutional values that have always been the backbone of what America means. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back to the show. The question I was asking Dr. Orient just before the break was that we hear all the time that we should be taking the vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine, specifically because it's our responsibility to society. And yet Dr. Orient was saying that she recommends vaccines only when the benefits to the individual patient outweigh the risks to the patient. So Dr. Orient, what do you think of this argument that even if it's not beneficial to you, you should still take it to help our society at large?
I think from a philosophical standpoint, that argument is really, really flawed. I mean, is it my responsibility to risk death or some serious disability on the hypothetical chance that maybe possibly someday it might protect some vulnerable person who couldn't get the vaccine? Obviously, if the vaccine works, then a vaccinated person is not at risk from an unvaccinated person. But with this vaccine, it is not what they say a sterilizing vaccine. It is a leaky vaccine. It may prevent you from getting very sick or going to the ICU or maybe even dying, but it does not prevent you from getting infected or from shedding virus, even asymptomatically. So the public health thing that you are protecting somebody else from this is just not, it's just not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense.
A friend of ours who attends DDP, Doctors for Disaster Preparedness, every year, wrote a book titled Polio last year. Are you familiar with the book?
No, I have not seen that book.
I'll have to send it to you. She's a regular at the meeting, but...
Oh, yes, I guess I did see the book. Yes, okay, yes, I did. And polio is one of the things that they're saying, well, we've got to eradicate polio. You know, smallpox is maybe the only disease that allegedly has been obliterated. It was obliterated several times during millennia, it just disappeared for some reason and then came back. This time we credit the vaccine, even though it was combined with a lot of very vigorous public health efforts. Now polio, they say we could eradicate polio, but we haven't gotten there yet because there's some holdouts, say in India or Pakistan or in Africa. So Bill Gates is sending his vaccinators around. People are hiding their children. Some of these vaccinators have even been assaulted despite police escorts because the parents have discovered that the oral polio vaccine is giving people paralyzing polio. They won't use the killed vaccine like we use here in the US, saying, well, it's just not adequate to eradicate the disease. And so if some of these little African or Pakistani babies get paralyzed, well, that's just collateral damage. That's the price we have to pay. And now we have this acute flaccid myelitis, which looks a lot like polio. We don't know exactly what causes it, but it's still there. So we haven't eradicated the
theme of the book Polio was that polio would have been eliminated when I was a kid without the vaccine, that it was on its way out. Again, I have no expertise in it, and you may, you know, not be familiar enough with it either, but that was the whole point of the book, that without the vaccine that is credited with primarily eliminating polio in this country, it was on its way out anyway. Do you have any knowledge or opinion on that?
Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't read the whole book, but I would say that a lot of diseases do come and go, especially if you develop enough herd immunity. Most babies, if they get polio, they don't even have any symptoms, but they can shed it from their GI tract. It really is a disease that has fecal oral transmission, and so they may infect older people who get paralyzed. But, you know, once you get a certain amount of natural immunity, the disease will fade. Moreover, polio may actually be treatable. There was this family doctor in North Carolina, Frederick Klenner was his name, who was treating during the polio outbreak, polio epidemic. He was treating children with intravenous vitamin C, and his patients did not get paralyzed and they did not die. Whether they'll have polio or not, I don't know. He was out in the country. He wasn't doing spinal taps on everybody, but they certainly, during an outbreak, they had the clinical symptoms that were suspicious. And he treated them. His work was published, I think, in the JAMA. But because the polio vaccine came along, people lost interest in this, which is probably a huge tragedy, because this sort of treatment might be effective against all kinds of other viral diseases as well.
Wow. And I guess one of the concerns with this new vaccine for COVID is that as the count goes down, people will say, oh, that's evidence that the vaccines work, and push it even more.
But the disease is not going down. So people are suggesting that maybe it is exerting selection pressure on the virus so that mutant strains that are resistant to the vaccine are proliferating, which will mean that it's a disaster, and it will make the vaccine ineffective.
I heard that your natural immunity is a much broader spectrum. It covers more kinds of variants of the disease in comparison with the vaccine. Is that correct?
Yes, and that only makes sense, because if you have the whole virus or an attenuated form of the virus, there are all kinds of epitopes in the virus that your immune system might react to. So if you get a mutant strain of the virus, it may have some differences, but share some of the things that you have antibodies to or killer T cells for. So the natural immunity is broader. The vaccine immunity is purposely extremely narrow. It is only for the spike protein, and it causes your body to make unlimited amounts of the spike protein. It puts the genetic material in you. There's no off switch for when you stop making spike protein. And it could be that this spike, whether it's attached to the virus or not, can attach to the lining of your blood vessel and provoke an immune reaction and cause damage and lead to blood clots and to myocarditis and neurologic things. Like the spike protein by itself penetrates the blood-brain barrier, which the whole virus does not. So we may have just picked the very worst part of the virus to make ourselves generate antibodies for.
So if I understand rightly, then, if the vaccine is very narrow in its application and the COVID mutates more and more to all different, doesn't that sort of, isn't that a recipe for more and more and more different, very narrow vaccines in the future?
Well, I think that might be the objective, but, you know, we talk about the Delta variant and there's the Alpha and Beta, but if they're not hard to find on the web, the different different kinds of viruses, it goes far, I mean, more variations than there are letters in the Greek alphabet. They're just a huge number. The Delta variant is the one that's prominent at the moment.
Wow. So we may see needs for double, triple, quadruple boosters for all different variants.
It's sort of related, but I've often heard that parents who try to sterilize their children in the sense of not letting them be exposed to dirt and the normal things in the atmosphere are doing their children no favor, because by exposing young kids to everything out in the environment would help give them a defense as they go through life. How would you summarize that argument?
It's called the hygiene hypothesis, that if you keep people from developing their immune system by stimulating it, then they will have a crippled immune system. It's just like these bubble children that had immune deficiency. You can keep them in a bubble for a while, but as soon as you let them out, they have no competency in their immune system whatsoever. So eating dirt may be good for you. I mean, I'm not encouraging it, but it is a fact that all animals kiss their babies. All mothers kiss their babies or lick them if they're animals. And this is so the mother can find out what's in the environment and maybe transmit some antibodies to her offspring with breastfeeding. So, I mean, you look what the animals do and what all mothers do, and there may be some good natural reason for it.
Yeah. Now, how has third-party medical payments affected the costs and efficacy of medical treatment? Has that actually influenced it?
Well, that's a whole broader subject, but I think that as far as COVID-19 is concerned, there is an incentive to diagnose it because hospitals get paid more. If the patients die of COVID, there are even incentives like to use remdesivir because they get a 20% bonus on certain aspects of payment if they use it. And that may be why they will not let you decline consent for remdesivir if you're coming in for say, spine surgery. Or maybe, and I've even heard them kicking patients out of the hospital who declined consent to get that. And I strongly suspect that there's a financial motive behind that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
but let's go back before COVID, and just, you know, in the world before COVID a couple of years ago, what is your opinion of third party medical payments that has really taken over in the last couple of decades? I mean, has it caused medical treatment to be not as good as it once was, or is it in fact improving medical treatment?
I think that if we had to find one main cause for all of the ailments in our medical system, third-party payment would be at the top of the list. It really does make a difference who pays the bill. Whose bread I eat, his song I must sing. And if you are getting paid by the third party instead of by the patient, there are all kinds of incentives on both sides, the doctor's side and the patient's side, to overuse things, to prefer things that the third party pays for, and to stay away from things that the insurance does not pay for. All kinds of incentives for fraud. The patients may say, well, if you put it this way, my insurance company will pay. And if you put it some other way, they won't. The whole ICD-9 codes or now ICD-10 codes or the current procedure terminology codes that has to go on every Medicare claim, they're made up by the CPT codes are owned by the AMA. And if there's not a code for it, it doesn't exist and you can't get paid for it by the insurance company. But if it pays very well, then there's all kinds of an incentive to do it. Mm-hmm. So I think that it just really corrupts everything.
Mm-hmm. You were saying there's a strong incentive for people to declare something a COVID sickness. And, you know, it's interesting. A friend of mine works in death and dying in one of our governments in Canada. She wouldn't want me to identify which government because it would show who she was. But she said, and she looks at all the death certificates and deals with the families and et cetera. And she says that the idea that only about 10% of the COVID deaths are really caused by COVID is probably about right. I mean, do you think that's probably true?
I've looked at the reasoning there, and I think that is quite plausible. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they can call a gunshot wound or a motorcycle crash death from COVID and not just the patient had an incidentally positive test, since they screen everybody for COVID and probably 90% of them are false positives. If they can do that, they can attribute that to COVID. And since they're not doing autopsies, we just really don't know what the final diagnosis is, and testimony of undertakers and other people suggests that at least a lot of them are wrong. 90% of them being wrong could be.
Mm-hmm. So when they say one in 500 Americans have died from COVID, that's probably way off.
Oh, I think it's way off. I don't know what it is. And how can you find out what it is when your statistics are so corrupted?
Mm-hmm, right.
Well, there's been a joke going around most of the last year that in the United States for the past year, nobody has died of old age. And certainly those deaths are less, although the statistics I saw for the number of deaths in 2019 versus 2020 before COVID, about the same number of people in the United States died as in the year with COVID. That didn't make any sense to me. Have you seen any of those numbers?
Well, yes. And there are people who say that the excess mortality rate, we did have a spike at one point at the beginning of the epidemic, but now it's about down to normal and maybe even lower than some years in past decades. So it certainly doesn't look like a pandemic. And yeah, the average age of death of COVID is higher than the life expectancy. So mm-hmm. most of the people who are dying probably were living longer than expected anyway.
When we were talking just before the call, I was asking you about Dr. Atlas's numbers, where he said approximately one in 2,000 people under the age of 70 who get COVID die. And you were saying you thought that was probably a reasonable number.
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. But again, it depends on are you making the accurate diagnosis? There's no question that it can be an extremely serious disease, that it can be unpredictably serious, even in young people who don't have comorbidities, of which probably the most important one is obesity. Mm-hmm. So that's why I really firmly believe that everybody who might have COVID needs early treatment.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to shift the conversation to socialized medicine. Tom lives in Canada and is exposed to socialized medicine almost every day. I'd like your opinion as to how has socialized medicine worked in other countries. It certainly looks like that's where our government has been taking us for a very long time.
Well, the answer to that question depends a lot on whom you ask. If you ask healthy people who don't have to worry about paying medical bills if they get sick, and they say, oh, it's just really wonderful. If you ask sick people who can't get in to get their diagnosis, or who can't even get into the after-hours clinic, or who are in a lottery to get a primary care physician without whom in Canada you can't get to see a specialist, or people who are suffering and dying on the waiting list, you'll get a different answer. So certainly the cost per capita in Canada is not that much better. Maybe it's even worse than here. And a lot of Canadians depend on the safety net south of the border to come if they really have something serious and they need treatment.
Well, yeah, what a great answer. It never occurred to me how accurate that must be. It all depends on whether you're healthy or not, whether you are happy with the socialized medicine. And as I go back in my memory bank, the number of people I have talked to line up exactly that way. I've had people who have waited 6 months for a operation they needed. I know people who have crossed the border, and I know people who have not complained a bit, and it's fine. And by and large, they're all extremely healthy people. So really appreciate that, Jane.
They may also be ideologically committed to the idea that Canadian medicine is wonderful, and it's really selfish of them to try to jump the queue, and it just isn't right. So they will suffer feeling that they are just being virtuous.
Yeah.
What's your experience, Tom?
Well, my mother 15 years ago, and she's passed away now, but they discovered some sort of dark mark on her brain in some sort of scan. And they needed to have more extensive scans and more extensive investigation. So they scheduled her for an examination, a proper scan, 10 months in the future. And my dad said, well, if it's serious, by then she could have passed away. So he eventually gave up on the Canadian system, and he went to New York State and had it done right away for $7,000. Turned out it wasn't a serious problem. But they then came back to Canada and canceled the appointment. So, you know, yeah, it's great to get it for free, but if it's going to be 10 months in the future, I mean, that's no good.
Jane, how would you compare today's management of our health by the medical profession to what it was in your youth?
I think that in the past, every doctor felt it was his responsibility to get the diagnosis right, to get the treatment right, and generally truly cared about his patients. But he was seeing patients over a period of time. These days, it's hard to get to care about your patients because maybe they're on your list and they get to see whichever provider is on the schedule that day, or their provider may be a nurse practitioner and you may officially be the patient's doctor, but you are remote. You may never see the patient at all, even when they're in the hospital. You may not even see their chart routinely. So I think that just the doctor-patient relationship is being undermined in so many ways. One of them being just the shift work mentality that physicians get and the intense pressure to spend so much time on the electronic medical record and just busy work of all kinds, that they're just churning patients through like they're on a treadmill. They cannot possibly get to care about them.
I've read about something called concierge medicine, or some doctors that have signed people up at a fee to take care of them through the year and take no insurance at all. It seems that must be a very small niche. What could you tell us about it?
I think that this is growing, except that concierge practice was generally pretty high priced and for people who could afford a lot. But there's now direct primary care or direct patient care or DPC practices that may be quite reasonable, maybe $100 a month. It includes unlimited office visits, unlimited phone calls, a lot of the lab work. The ability to get medicines that the doctor can dispense at cost. And so many patients are flocking to this, but it gives the doctor enough of a reliable stream of income that the doctor can afford to keep his doors open and not be constantly fighting with insurance companies and wasting most of his time on busy work.
Mm-hmm. Is one of the main problems the cost of advanced technology, advanced equipment, that sort of thing?
I think that advanced technology really should bring prices down, just like it has in every other part of the economy. I think the difference is here is that somebody else is paying the bill. Or if you just look at bills, and I think like Ralph Weber, who's an insurance person, has looked at this, that the difference in price from one procedure to another can be tenfold higher in the hospital than if you get it in a doctor's office or an ambulatory facility or an independently owned imaging center. But what's happening is these states have certificate of need programs that makes it impossible for these independent facilities to exist, much less compete with the hospitals that are overcharging by factors of 10.
Sure. Wow.
What would you advise our listeners? I'll make this a two-part question. Where do you think the country can go to right itself in terms of medical treatment, reducing costs and increasing care? And what would you tell an individual concerned with their own care, what they can do to improve it economically and from a health benefit standpoint?
I think it's very important for every patient to try to find an independent physician who is working for that individual, who is not dependent on the third party, who's not a member of every network, but who is able to treat the patient on an individual basis, which means the patient pays on an individual basis. People think that's outrageously expensive, but if they looked into the prices, they would find that that is not necessarily true. It may be very difficult to find out prices, but with research, you can do that. And if you compare it with the, what you're paying for your so-called insurance every month, maybe we should express the price in percentage of your monthly premium, which for which you may get nothing whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Jane, you're head of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. Does your organization have lists of doctors like that? Or where would you find in your area, your neighborhood, a doctor that essentially you describe that could really be your primary doctor and not bury you in paperwork?
I wish I had a better answer to that. There have been various enterprises that try to put together directories. And so far as I know, all of them have failed. You look for a doctor in your area, you may find no one. The AAPS website, which is aapsonline.org, has a patients tab on it. And if you click on that, we do have lists of practices that have listed themselves in by state who are friendly to self-pay patients. I mean, not all practices will even accept you if you want to self-pay. Mm-hmm. But this is a beginning. I think more and more doctors are going into direct primary care. There is a direct primary care organization. They may have a list. I need to look into that. But you may just have to do some research on your own. Look at potential doctors, look on their website, see how many plans they're signed up with, and maybe even do some telephone research, call their offices and ask. Mm-hmm. Well, you're sick.
Oh yeah, for sure. We'll put a link to the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons and highlight that particular link for patients. Now, tomorrow you're actually taking part in the 78th annual meeting in Pittsburgh of the AAPS. And can you tell us about that and also the talk that you're delivering, which is titled Medical Diagnosis, Bridging Art and Science?
This will be our annual meeting in Pittsburgh. You can register for the online thing. If you go to our website and look for current events, you should be able to register if you want to participate online. There is continuing medical education credit. You can see the entire agenda. I am speaking about The Art and Science of Bedside Diagnosis, which is the title of my book that's now in its fifth edition. And it talks about, we'll be talking about how to evaluate diagnostic tests, what are the important parts of the art of medicine that are being just lost these days. And I think that maybe this will give people some insight into COVID, because the controversy about what a diagnostic test means is especially pertinent today. We'll have a number of talks about COVID diagnosis and treatment, but there are many other things in the meeting as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's great. So that was a really interesting interview. Did you have any other questions you wanted to ask Dr. Orion, Jay, before we wrap up?
I do. I've read that more doctors are retiring early because of the frustration of the paperwork and the insurance companies. If that's so, is there any potential shortage of doctors in the future as young people get turned off by things they learn about the medical practice?
I think this is a threat. I don't have really reliable statistics about it, and probably more threatening to do it than have actually done it. More of them may do it if their state or county imposes a demand that they get one of these COVID shots, I think that we're going to have a loss of physicians who were trained in the old-fashioned patient-centered method. We have patients, we have doctors who are dependent on income from an employer who will be spending most of their effort getting the electronic health record up to date and who never have been exposed to the possibility of direct patient care or of even making a differential diagnosis instead of just plugging in the electronic health record and looking at the drop-down menu about what you can and can't do.
Well, I hope that things can turn around and improve. And I'm very excited that you say there are more doctors taking patients on a direct basis without insurance and charging reasonable things. And for our listeners who are not satisfied with what they're getting in their lives, it's certainly something to look for and do their own research. But that it would be great if we could go back to what I remember as a youth, which was exactly what you described, a doctor that knew me, cared for me over a long period of time, and did a great job. And you were actually excited when I go back to the day of house calls, but you were even excited to go to a doctor's office and see your friend, the doctor. So
yeah,
maybe one day we can get back to that.
Yeah, that was great. In those days, my doctor was a friend of the family. I mean, he was not just a doctor or she. So that was a great interview with Dr. Jane Orient. And she's at the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons conference at 78th meeting in Pittsburgh. People can check out their website. We'll include a link to it underneath the podcast. And we'll also include a link to her new book, Concerning Bridging Art and Science in Medical Diagnosis. So this is Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris signing out from the other side of the story.